Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we are broadcasting live from the Food and Farm Exploration Center in Plover. And we have a full house of great listeners, and I'm really looking forward to today's show because we're talking with three people who have been very much involved in the center here, and they're going to be telling us about it and some of the things that are going on here. Three guests for you. As I said, Dick Pavelski is the owner of Heartland Farms, a major potato and vegetable grower in the Central Sands region, and he is the founder and president of the Food and Farm Exploration Center, which opened December 2023 in Plover. Dick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thanks for visiting us at the Food and Farm Exploration Center, Larry.
What a great facility. Kathleen O'Leary is with us as well, transition and culture strategist for the Food and Farm Exploration Center, former CEO and executive director of Wisconsin State Fair Park. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you to the listener for being at the Food and Farm Exploration Center today.
And Bobby Kubish is Director of Educational Programming of the Food and Farm Exploration Center. Previously spent 23 years at UW-Stevens Point, where she served as an outreach specialist for the Wisconsin Center for Environmental Education. She was Program Manager, Interim Director of the Central Wisconsin Environmental Station as well. So, Bobby, welcome to you.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
So these, I was remarking to them earlier, how would you find three people with more experience, of the right kind of experience, to head up an operation like we have here? Dick, for, you know, your family's been going on for five generations here, and I think you started with your great-great-grandfather started?
The original farm was in Amherst Junction, and started in 1873 when my great-grandfather immigrated from Poland.
Man. And you had what? How many acres back then?
Well, they originally settled on 40 acres that were homesteaded, and then basically grew that, and it was about 180 to 200 acres when I graduated from high school. Well, when I started on the farm, and then my father grew it to about 200 acres in the Amherst Junction area, and then again a few years later it got to about 600 acres as he acquired more of the neighbor's land, and then we bought another operation down in the Hancock, Wisconsin area when I graduated from high school and joined the farm, and that took us up to about 1400 acres.
And now there's a lot more even.
Thousands. we've taken on a couple of partners as well with the Knights family and the Kennedy family, but we're now up to where we own about 13,000 acres and farm a total of about 27,000 acres.
And I understand that Heartland Farms hosted school field trips, which might have been kind of the genesis for getting this operation going.
Going back, basically what happened is back in 2010 as a family, and we supply a fair amount of potatoes to Frito-Lay for potato chips, and in 2010 we were at the state fair with a project that they called Fresh Rush, where we harvested potatoes at 4 o'clock in the morning on the farm, delivered them to their Beloit processing plant. They delivered them to the fairway by about 11 o'clock that morning, and we as the farmers, I and my wife and my son and his wife were there and handing out chips and basically telling the story about they are just potatoes and they're grown in Wisconsin. And people kept coming up, or several of them came up and said, no, you are not real farmers, you're just actors, there are no real farmers anymore. And and we had video of us harvesting, and we had raw potatoes there, and it was kind of one of those deals that it was really kind of a wake-up for me that people really don't have a sense of where their food comes from. And so that at that point in time, we went back and we did start saying, as a family, decided we needed to do something to try to reconnect people with where their food comes from. and we started doing bus tours at Heartland Farms. And it started out with just like four or five a year, and then the next thing it was 30 or 40, and then it was, you know, motorcycle groups and senior tour groups, and it really got to the point where, and I worked mostly on the government relations finance side of the farm operation when it got that large, and my partner walked in my office one day and said, you know, Dick, I know we need to do this, and it's a great project, and our employees and operators certainly enjoy talking to the children and school trips. But they were supposed to be planting potatoes today, not talking to school kids all day. And it's starting to affect our operations on the farm. And then, you know, we would actually let them get on machinery and stuff like that at the farm. And it got to the point where we had, you know, at times we'd have two or three buses up to 100 kids at a time. And it made it very apparent that if we kept trying to do it on an actual farm with live machinery, we may have some safety concerns. So that's when, as a family, we decided we wanted to try to build a mini farm to continue the mission.
And more than a year or two, we have the center here, the Food and Farm Exposition Center, and it is an amazing facility.
Yeah, this center, and most people don't understand because it was really a family project that we wanted to do it. Kept it that way for a while, but it was in the planning stages for 5 years before we ever really went public talking to anyone about it. And a lot of that was because, you know, as we wanted to hire the right people to do the job, we hired a firm out of California called Gyroscope to do all of the exhibits, and you'll see those downstairs if you haven't already. There's about $10 million of high-tech exhibits. I'm very fortunate. My daughter-in-law is an architectural engineer, so what you see here was pretty much designed by Alicia Pavelski, my daughter-in-law. And then basically we took it and I started talking, and it was gonna be a much smaller project. It was just gonna be kind of a family. But as I took it to other growers, and one of them being the Warzelas, where we're located now, basically said, hey, you know, why do you wanna build it down in Hancock, Wisconsin, where your farm is? You don't have all of the infrastructure like the restaurants and the hotels and things that you need to support a center of this size and scope. And he called us a couple days later and said that they would just donate whatever land we wanted, so we got to choose the site at no cost to us next to the park. They were very generous. And then as we talked to more and more farmers, as we talked to more farmers and our suppliers, you know, the equipment suppliers, on the farm, the irrigation, you'll see all three major manufacturers represented here. They all realized that it was an issue that had to be addressed because we did continue to get people, and now you see it on social media all the time with people commenting that I don't know why we need farmers anymore, we just go to the grocery store for our food. And obviously as a farmer, that kind of got under my skin a bit, so we decided that we had to try to do something about it.
Well, Dick gave me a little quick tour. You could spend a few days here, I think, pretty much covering everything. And Kathleen O'Leary, you're the transition and cultural strategist. Now, what is that? First.
Oh, goodness. Well, to have a wonderful facility like this, obviously 50,000 square feet on 24 acres, and having a lot of pillars with education being at the forefront. Education, operations, certainly you're sitting in a beautiful 10,000 square foot event space. We needed to recruit people, right? So my quick story is I was, as Larry said, the CEO of Wisconsin State Fair for 6 years and spent 25 years of my career at Wisconsin State Fair Park in a variety of marketing and communications positions, and agriculture is the cornerstone of the fair industry. So I retired after those 6 years, 25 years, and just all I wanted was a summer, to have a summer with my girls. That's all I wanted. That's all I wanted. I did not have a script. I retired, so there wasn't anything adversarial by any stretch of the imagination. I left it better than I found it. And I just didn't know what was going to be next, but I didn't need to know. So I had my summer, and the architect that was part of building and designing this building called me up, and I had known him from Wisconsin State Fair Park, and he said, Kathleen, and this is the president of Epstein Ewan Architects, so they do projects all around the country. He said, Kathleen, you know, A, I hope you're enjoying your retirement, and B, I am working on one of the most incredible projects of my career. I said, oh, Rich Tennyson, tell me more. And this is, he said, it is just an amazing, amazing facility. The mission is incredible, and agriculture is at the forefront, and the education. It's about educating at every turn, connecting that disconnect of what most people don't know and understand about how our food really gets to our table. So the chapter begins, and I stepped in to do a little bit of consulting, and then was the interim executive director for a window of time, and now really that that great title is more or less a little bit of everything. I would consider myself what I would call a trusted advisor. So it's been 2 full years, and it has been amazing to just watch Dick Pavelski and a number of people in the community's dream become reality, the whole Pavelski family. So that is the story of who I am and why I'm here.
It's a great story. And what I like about the center, Dick said we're agnostic here. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. We are interested in small organic farmers, large organic farmers, small commercial operations, large commercial operations, every kind of manufacturer. It's an education.
Yeah, I mean, our view is that food comes from everywhere. It doesn't, you know, come from any one source. The customer is always boss, as you know, and the customer will always get, you, the end consumer, will always get what you want typically in the grocery store. So everybody, you know, all of those, that variety should be available. It's the way our society operates, and we agree with it, so.
Well, let's talk maybe a bit, Kathleen, maybe, or, well, we'll get Bobby involved here, too, but what can visitors expect to see at the Food and Farm Exploration Center? That's amazing.
Well, certainly it's, and I do, there's so many comparisons to the fair, right? The agnostic part, and this is about the industry of agriculture all being showcased here. Obviously, the focus is on crops, vegetables, potatoes. But when you come in, it's something that you could come in with all of the different genres. So you can have the littles with you, you can have your teens with you, it can be mom and dad, aunt and uncle, and grandma and grandpa. Because what you get when you get here, and for the price of admission, we talked about the exhibits. So there's 60 plus exhibits, they're all hands-on, they're all immersive, there's learning behind everything and every one of them, and that's obviously how that resonates a little bit better when you understand something because you're doing it. So when you enter into the Food and Farm Exploration Center, number one, it's a beautiful place, if I think that all of you would agree. And it's a very welcoming. So the foyer is where we have lecture series and where we have tot time. So the parents are, you know, that the kids are being read to. We have a colorful plate cafe that is just wonderful. Breakfast and lunches and everything is locally sourced. Healthy, obviously, we have 4 demonstration fields, so we actually would use our produce that we harvest in the demonstration fields in the Colorful Plate Cafe. But you move through the Exploration Center and you move into the kitchen lab. And Bobby's going to talk a little bit about that, but that is just, again, another interactive space, place where you can do culinary events. We work closely with Mid-State. We work closely with all of the colleges, so UW-Madison, UW-Cal's, UW-Stevens Point, all the surrounding technical colleges, and Mid-State is one of our partners that we're working with on a lot of the programming that we do in the kitchen lab. And then you move into the Ag STEM Gallery, the pivotal part of the whole Exploration Center. There's a side that's seedlings, and that's for our little learners, right? That's going to take them through. They have a grocery store and how to see the produce on the perimeter of the stores, getting that feel. There's a food truck. There's a kitchen. So, again, hands-on, involved. Mom and dad are involved. Everybody's involved with not only teaching but learning themselves, right? So then you move into the Ag STEM Gallery, and that is where it takes you through cultivation, irrigation, certainly the harvest process, everything about soils and what soils are good for what crops and those type of things. And then it's really great about what happens when it comes out of the ground, because that too is what people just do not understand, not only the complexity, but what it takes. So the optical sorters, getting them out, making sure that the good ones are kept and the other ones are thrown away, and then the storage, and then is it frozen, is it fresh, are we canning, what are we doing? So that has a whole process, and then it takes you through the logistics of travel. So is it a short haul, is it a long haul? So it goes through the whole process, and again, everybody's learning, everybody's having fun. There's one great one where it's on the transportation where you can do a selfie after you do it. So there's all kinds of fun things. An air hockey one that is about harvest. And then we have a maker's lab. We have a farm tech shed where we're always bringing in new equipment, all state-of-the-art equipment, so people can get up close, live, personal, understand the magnitude and the enormity of some of these industry equipment. So, and then upstairs is a beautiful event space that overlooks the demonstration fields. 250 people can fit into this room in various ways. Certainly we have our observation deck. So lots of different wonderful things to have events here or spend the day. And to what Dick said and will continue to say, excuse me, I need a sip of water here. What Dick said is it's not a museum. This is a science and tech center. So it's not one and done. Right, you came here, you come back tomorrow when we're open and you all enjoy it. You come back in 3 weeks, 2 months, there's always going to be something different, always something ever-changing. So that's the beauty of what we're doing here.
And Bobby, we're going to give you a chance to talk too, I promise you. But we need to take a short break here for our guests, Dick Pavelski, Kathleen O'Leary, and Bobby Kubish, as we talk with them about the Food and Farm Exploration Center. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Broadcasting live today from the Food and Farm Exploration Center with a great audience here to learn about the center and three guests, Dick Pavelski, Kathleen O'Leary. We've talked to them. We haven't talked to Bobby Kubish yet, so I want to get her involved. She's director of educational programming. And by the way, I got entranced with everything and forgot to mention the phone numbers and how you can contact. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the audience and have a question, our live audience here, just raise your hand and Jill Nadeau will be around with a microphone and you can ask those questions. We certainly appreciate it and look forward to hearing questions from you. But Bobby, you're director of educational programs, and you come with, again, great background with your work at UW-Stevens Point. And I got to imagine that kind of training played a beautiful role getting involved here.
I think so. At the time when they posted this position, I was not looking for a different job. The College of Natural Resources, my colleagues there, were they're really family to me, and they still are. However, when I saw the posting, I could check all the boxes. So definitely my experience in outreach with the Wisconsin Center for Environmental Education, my work with the Central Wisconsin Environmental Station, both as program manager and director there, interim director. And then I also was the coordinator of the College of Natural Resources Student Success Center for about 15 years. So again, the career piece within agriculture was a big box that the Pavelskis and the donors wanted to check as well. And outside of that, I really, what attracted me to this was the idea of building bridges and relationships within the community and connecting people who maybe weren't connecting or talking in the past. So that's one of the reasons I really enjoy this position right now. I really like Dick's philosophy is that we need to talk with each other instead of past each other. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the perfect opportunity and place to do that.
Well, maybe let's talk about some of the educational opportunities mm-hmm. that exist here. Maybe we start with, well, I'll let you start with where
sure.
you want to start.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kathleen did a really nice job of talking about the exhibit space that we have, and I hope the audience will check that out before they leave today. But of course, one of our key players is the general public, trying to educate the public about production ag and agriculture in general within the state. Agriculture here in the state contributes $104 billion to our economy, so it is a very big player. And there's upwards of 400,000 jobs plus that are created through the various levels of agriculture. So we want to educate the public in general about what's happening and how their food gets to the table. One of the things that has surprised me, being most of my background in natural resources, is just the upgrades, the precision agriculture, the innovation that I did not have a good understanding of, and I'm learning more about every day. And I think that's something that's really important to us, to try to get that out to the general public as well as partners out there within the community. We've been doing that in a variety of ways. One of the ways is just getting people to walk through our fields that we have out there. We have 4 1.2-acre fields, and we have focus crops or cover crops that we have within those fields, and we invite the public to come in and walk through. Some public have never walked through a conventional field before, and so, you know, get out there, walk through them, ask us questions, and also take a look at the irrigation systems that we have. And, you know, irrigation can be a bit of a hot topic here. We all know we are not the experts on that. We bring in experts. But the precision in irrigation is really exciting. At one of the programs that we have tomorrow night, actually, at the doors open at 5:30, but at 6 p.m., is irrigation innovation. So learning from the experts about the precision in irrigation systems and in agriculture in general. So trying to work with the general public, families, getting them out here into the fields, talking to us, as well as adult educational programs like our irrigation program tomorrow night. We've had a series of programs all summer called Ag After Hours, trying to get adults here. We had the exhibits open for them so that they could explore them without their children present or other people's children present. And so that they could just kind of read and go through them, and we could be there for them. And some of the other topics that we've had within that was pollinators in production ag. And so trying to educate about that, not only general public, but growers, about topics not only like integrated pest management, but integrated pest and pollinator management, right? So what's up and coming? What is the research that we want to get out there? We've talked about just what is production ag and the economics behind it. We've talked about soil health. And we've had speakers from both UW-Madison and UW-Stevens Point to work with our adult population there. The other area that is really big and that is kind of our focus right now, because we want to get it right before we move on to too many other things, but of course, is our youth education program. So currently, we have a couple facets with that program where, number one is we provide field trips to the center. And as soon as we opened our doors in December, I started working in November, we opened our doors early December, and we have had over upwards of 80-some schools and youth groups that came through the doors. We've talked to over 5,000 children. And, of course, I am not the one doing this. I have a wonderful education staff underneath me, 2 former ag educators, 2 elementary educators, and then a variety of just wonderful exhibit tech staff and our operations and exhibits director. So many, many people putting together these programs. So with the field trips, those have been very popular. Schools can come in and do open exploration, and they can also choose additional lessons that are directly related to various components of agriculture. And so those we call dig-ins. So that's an extra lesson throughout the day. We also do outreach to the classroom. So if a school is within 45 miles, we have an educator here that will go into the classrooms. And we really encourage the schools that come here to have our educators come into the classroom prior, and that way we can kind of prep them for what they're going to see and give them some foundational material. And with that, we've reached upwards of 2,400 students already going into the classrooms and about 30 classrooms that we've gone into. And we also offer downloadable lessons. So if a teacher or school is outside of that perimeter, we have wonderful lessons, and our ag educator is available to do a Zoom or a phone call with a teacher or a youth group if they want to know more. And as well, we have kits, what we call STEM kits, that are out there as well that teachers and groups can check out. And then lastly, probably one of our more popular programs that we've been putting on is through our partnership with Midstate, and that is our cooking classes and our beautiful kitchen lab. And I think that's one thing that you really can feel when the community walks in the center is their pride in this center. And taking classes, I was just participating in a class with Midstate this Saturday. I was assisting the chef, and the group had so much fun, and it was summer bounty, so it was taking all those vegetables that grow together, go together, right, and cooking them, and the class had a really wonderful time. And we, our educators at Food and Farm, are expanding those classes to teens and also elementary age kids and families, so that's been a lot of fun to do that as well.
Yeah. I was thinking, Scott Craven, a wildlife ecologist, and I have taught some cooking classes together, and as I looked at that facility there, I thought, man, I wish Scott and I had something like this right here.
Well, come on back. Come on back. Teach a class.
I'll have to talk him into coming up here to teach a class. That would actually be a lot of fun. I want to, you know, both of you actually talked about the, well, three of you have talked about the advancements and the almost unbelievable technology that exists. Dick, I remember you talking when we were looking at crops and looking at somewhat blanking on, actually, pieces of equipment that you can fly them over a field, and they can pick up the individual plants' information.
Yeah, as I often say, you know, being a farmer today, the new technology that's being introduced to the farm is like drinking out of a fire hose, because there's just all kinds of things coming. One of the things that Larry, and you'll see a video downstairs, is now on drones and hyperspectral imagery. And we're now getting to the point where on any given crop, they can actually look at not only the nutrient level, but the nutrient flow within individual plants. You'll see a grading equipment that actually is not only, you know, it'll automatically grade defects like a green potato or a piece of rot or a bruised potato, but they can now actually also sense the chemistry within the potato, so we can sense glucose levels to make sure that your potato chips are the right color when they get to the plant. You know, the same type of thing is now happening with water and precision irrigation, as we mentioned. At Heartland Farms, by going to variable rate irrigation, which means that every sprinkler on those pivot systems is controlled separately based on how much water that soil and that plant needs, we reduced our water usage by about 25%, and we're actually producing higher yield and higher quality with that technology. So,
didn't that go back to some work that you had with NASA back quite a long time back?
Yeah, I do have a long and sordid career in this business. It actually was kind of interesting, because what happened is the original military satellite system lasted longer than they wanted, or than they expected it to. So the military got a new, that had definition at the Earth's surface of 3 meters. This would be back in 1975, 77. So they sent out some, offered universities grants to utilize that technology, because they were going to have their new military precision that had definition at the earth's surface of less than a foot. And somehow I got a phone call from a professor out in a university out in Oklahoma that said, you know, I'd like to talk to you because, and we were already being involved in equipment that could do variable rate fertilizer applications. And we partnered up, ended up doing some stuff then with with NASA and the university and utilizing that technology to drive variable rate application.
And so you needed the equipment to be able to do that, obviously. If you know, you've got to have equipment that's going to be able to tell when it needs to be, what needs to be added when.
Yeah, I mean, it has, so much has changed since then. One of the, you know, at that point in time, basically, we had soil tests, and we would go out and do, you know, a really thorough soil test. So typically in soil tests, you're pulling 4 samples on 40 acres. We were pulling as many as 300 on 40 acres, trying to get a much more accurate picture, and then drawing a map from there. And that was driving the variable rate application so that wherever, you know, if you had a higher level of phosphate already in the soil, you would apply less if you had a. But the real issue that and how that's evolved now is obviously that was taking an average of what's in the soil, and soil tests are not always absolutely accurate. We found that you go to work and pull one soil sample, split it between three laboratories, and find as much as a 20% difference at the time. So, you know, and at the time, there were some companies come out saying that we can give you precision agriculture within, you know, 2 or 3%. I'm saying, no, I know better than that. But now, because of the sensor technology that's been developed by a lot of the space program, I mean, they're taking soil samples on the moon and things like that. We've got sensors, and that's what's really evolved most rapidly in the last 10 years is that sensor technology. They've gotten much better, much more accurate, whether it be soil moisture testing, soil fertility testing, or plant nutrient testing.
Amazing work. Dick Pavelski, Kathleen O'Leary, and Bobby Kubish are guests today as we talk with them about the Food and Farm Exploration Center. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. And if you're in our live audience and have a question or a comment, just raise your hand and Jill Nadeau will be there with a microphone. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're broadcasting from Plover, Wisconsin today with a great audience and talking about the Food and Farm Exploration Center, which has only been up for how many months now?
About 8 months.
It's a fantastic facility. I think around 50,000 square feet of space for people to explore and learn a whole lot about agriculture, not only in this part of the state, but anywhere, as a matter of fact. You can join in. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org, or we'll take a question from the audience, and we have a question or two, so let's go there.
This question is for Dick. With much fondness driving back and forth from Wausau to Madison, I always saw the airplanes that took care of the pesticides, and I imagine with all your technology, you don't use that anymore, do you?
Yes, airplanes are still used along with ground application equipment. The newest technology that's coming on is drones, however. We can fly them much lower. We can get much more precision in the application. And because of the downdrift of the propellers, when we're flying that low, we actually get much better plant coverage and can reduce the amount of pesticide or plant protectants that we're using.
Yeah. Here's another question from the audience.
This is mainly for Dick as well. I know you were talking about the planes. I grew up and not grew up, but lived last 40, almost 50 years in Enigo area. And when we came and I was in the concrete business, we put an awful lot of pivot pads in the early 70s for the irrigation. I was just wondering now, with all the high capacity wells that you must be, the amount that's pumped out is amazing, because, you know, because of our soil content, people would say to me, how can they keep irrigating and it's raining? And I said, well, because we have the state soil around Antigo silt dome, it could rain every day and you'd never get bogged down usually, but until time for harvest. But I was just wondering how are they addressing that, the aquifers, with all this high capacity pumping?
Yeah, actually, I mean, if you look at it, it's a pretty simple calculation. Wisconsin gets about, on average, 33 to 35 inches of rainfall a year. Crops, like potatoes, one of the biggest users, at about 17. Sweet corn, green beans will be down in that 12, 13 range. So from a, you know, and that includes the irrigation water, not only the rainfall that happens during the season. Trees actually are one of the biggest issues, because trees will use about 24, 25 inches a year. And further, they don't, because of any rain event that's over, you know, less than a half or three quarters of an inch falling on a pine forest, there's no recharge. None of that water, it stays on the leaves and the needles until it's evaporated, so there's no groundwater recharge. But basically, if you want to know what the groundwater table is here, you can just look off the deck, you'll see it. Groundwater in this area over the last 20 years has basically moved from it's all online. You can look at the USGS data. There's one at the Hancock Research Station. And I just looked at it the other day. Over the last 15 years, right now it's about 9 feet to groundwater from the soil surface. The farthest that it's been down is about 17 feet. And that's the fluctuation that you typically see between drought years, and you know, it was down to 17 after we had 4 years of well below average rainfall. Then we had 2 years and it came up, and for those that are locals, there's an area called Two Lakes, that's always Two Lakes Restaurant, we always referred to it as Two Lakes. And then for about 3 years it was referred to as No Lakes, because those ponds had dried up. And then 2 years after we had those 4 years of below normal rainfall, it's now referred to as Three Lakes, which is two lakes and a flooded basement. So it is a normal fluctuation. If you know history, back in the 1930s, my grandfather cut hay in the bottom of Lake Emily. That lake is typically, and I water skied on it all, so it's never been dry since, but it had dried up in the 30s when they had some really drought years. So.
Yeah, really interesting.
Do you mind if I add to that? Just
yeah, go ahead, Bobby.
So one of the things that we really want to emphasize here is that this center is meant to be neutral and to educate. And what I mean by that is that we want to remain agnostic, so that all of our growers, regardless of what size they are, feel welcome here, but also you know, individuals that are researching water quality issues and other types of issues. So we want to be able to demonstrate the latest technology, and we also want to be able to have researchers come in and talk to the public and growers about what is happening with research, which is why I think having the demonstration irrigation systems here is really exciting. And the more the public knows and understands, and the more that even the researchers out there understand the way that the technology is moving, it will help them to create research trials that hopefully will benefit all of us. So our mission is to demonstrate what's happening out there, not to do the research, but to do the demonstration of what the latest and greatest is.
Well said. Let's go to another call, question from the audience. Hi.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering, what is the role of the migrant workers in Wisconsin agriculture?
Yeah, I mean, we do use some H-2A farm workers at Heartland Farms, but it's very minimal. It's really interesting, because at Heartland Farms now, we've got about 140 full-time employees, and we'll bring in another 150 or so. And 90 of those are going to be truck drivers that operate, that are only there for about 10 to 12 weeks during harvest. And we actually, over the years, have gotten, you know, you'll get police officers and teachers and things that'll take time off just to work that harvest season for us. So, but we couldn't get enough of them the last couple of years. Before that, we were all locals. And now we're going to the point where, you know, we've brought, this year we'll have about 30 migrants that'll come in for harvest. But from us, they'll, a lot of them stay right in the area and they'll go to Christmas tree trimming after they finish the potato harvest. And then they go to North Dakota for some sugar beet harvesting
and move on. Yeah. Thanks for that question. Another question from the audience.
Okay, this is for Dick also. I recently read in a publication that I get about some research going on in Canada about actually using seeds for potatoes versus cut potatoes. I was wondering if anything like that is going on currently here.
There certainly is some research going on. And yeah, I'm aware of the article that you read. Historically, when you tried to use true seed, you could never get uniformity because of the genetics in each seed would be different. So I'm not totally familiar with it, but I know there's some research going on actually using true seed versus cut seed.
Okay. And another question from the audience. Good questions here. Another question from the audience.
Mine's for Barb. I was wondering if we, I'm sorry, you're not Barb, are you?
Bobby.
Bobby, sorry. I was wondering if there were going to be classes for adults who just wanted to have fun with food.
Yes. So currently we are in the process of hiring a kitchen lab facilitator. So once we get that individual on board, that is our hope, is to offer a variety of classes ourselves along with Mid-State and hopefully other partnerships within the community. So definitely is a goal for us, for adults, for families, youth. And what I would say again, you know, going back to education, that really is the mission of this facility. A couple of things that we have up and coming that we haven't even talked about is we are in the works of putting in a greenhouse. And so we will be hiring a greenhouse tech and hopefully growing some of our own food that we'll use in our cooking classes and our cafe as well as we'll have a children's playscape eventually. I believe it's coming that will be vegetable themed, of course. So lots of fun stuff coming, lots of ideas. As Dick mentioned, it's been like a fire hose in terms of ideas. So trying to build out gradually, what can we do well? What can we continue to improve on? And what are some areas that we can focus on? One partnership I do want to mention quickly is a partnership with a local community group, FarmShed. And through FarmShed, we, our director of operations, Heath, and others wrote a grant through the Community Development Foundation, and we were able to get macro bins. And so far, we've donated over 1,000 pounds of produce to FarmShed that they can process and send to our homeless shelters within the community. Wow. Give Heath a hand back there.
Yeah, if we could, I'd like to introduce Heath Dornfeld is in the back, manages the facility here. And next to him is Jen Scott. We mentioned about the outreach. Jen runs our outreach program that into the school system. Bobby runs the stuff in-house here from an educational standpoint.
It's amazing.
We've only been open since December, and we've had over 35,000 visitors through here, right? And as it is, you know, I mentioned technology in the farm. This place right now is kind of like drinking through a fire hose, right, too, because we've been growing, you know, so rapidly that we need some time to walk and staff up yet.
And we just filled up 2 macro bins on Friday of cucumbers that went to FarmShed that are not included in that in that poundage. But I will say, coming in September, we're estimating the 16th through the 18th are more you pick days, where the community can come in and you pick first before we load up those bins, so you can have fun with food in your own kitchen. So we had a lot of people who were picking cucumbers and beans to can. So keep an eye on Facebook and other publications for
and
that.
And go to your website.
Go to our website.
Your website
the events
would be
page.
Where
mm-hmm.
the events page would be where you'd be able to go and do this. Somebody else in the crowd wanted to know, where does the money come from? This is a $40 million project you got here. And then there's upkeep and a great staff.
Yeah, the $40 million was raised entirely, we got $3 million from the state. The other $37 million was all from donors, the Warzella family, our Pavelski family, Heartland Farms, John Deere. The list is on the donor wall downstairs, but we had, it was really very, very humbling for me because I said this was going to be a much smaller kind of family project, and it seemed like everybody we talked to for a while, it's like, geez, we should have been doing that. How can I help you out? And they wrote me a big check. So that's where that came from as far as, building the facility. That money's all been raised. We do need to raise about $1.5 million a year is the projection through donations on an annual basis. We just launched a program now where you can sponsor a busload of children coming in for, and you'll see that. I don't know if the brochures are out yet, but they will be shortly. So that will be basically through donations as well. And then there's about another $1.5 million that comes from, or is projected to come from, the actual rental revenue and, facilities like this. I can't see back there, but I think Nevada is also back there.
Yeah, cool.
Nevada heads up all the rental and the facility.
It's a great opportunity for a lot of people. And Kathy in Denver, Colorado, I think has a question for you from Denver. Hi, Kathy. Oh, we lost her.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I wanted to ask, I'm trying to get kids involved in the different STEM fields, and currently we have been doing Zooms, having different people take about an hour out of their whole life and talk to kids about their different fields. And one of the areas that we are looking at is like hydroponics and, growing plants and growing them in small areas and whatnot, and we want to do a little project. We get the families and the kid and maybe a parent or an uncle or an aunt, and they'll actually work with the child at home, so it gets more family interaction, and the kids can be all over the country. And I wondered if I could reach out to you. I'm also looking at a NASA grant to help encourage the STEM field
sort of
and
yeah.
space related fields too.
Yeah, go ahead. Bobby, you want to answer?
Well, Dick can add on to this, but this is what we mean by the fire hose. There's so many awesome ideas that are coming our way. Kathy, you can absolutely reach out to us. We have a couple general emails. You could email education@fftf.us or hello@fftf.us, and we will be in touch with some ideas. Dick, you were going to add to that?
I think you just go to the, mm-hmm. if you go to the Expo Center, if Kathy yep. or anybody else went to the
website, yep.
the Exploration Center website, you're mm-hmm. going to find the contact information.
Yep. Yeah, and we appreciate career development is clearly a very big part of what we're doing here, too. Agriculture, like a lot of other industries, is, I think, misunderstood as to what the career opportunities are here. Thank you, and yes, we'd certainly like to work together with on those career development programs.
Well, I want to thank the three of you for taking part in this today. The hour went by much faster than, it usually goes really fast, but today it seemed even faster than normal. Thank you so much. From the Food and Farm Expo Exploration Center, Dick Pavelski, the director, Kathleen O'Leary, cultural transition and culture strategist, and Bobby Kubish, director of education programming. They're doing a lot here, and it was fun to learn about it. And I hope you'll type in Food and Farm Exploration Center into your website, and you're gonna get to see everything that's going on here. Weather always plays a big role, whether you're growing potatoes or peas or whatever it is. And we got a weather guy coming up, a local weather guy who's gonna share what he knows about what's going on weather-wise here and elsewhere. Dick Pavelski, our guest, coming up. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we broadcast from the Food and Farm Exploration Center in Plover, Wisconsin. Great to have a live audience with us today. And you know, the last Monday of the month, we always have what we call the Weather Guys Show. And Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, are normally with us. But here we thought we would take an opportunity to get another weather guy involved in the operation because we're in Plover, Wisconsin today. And so we were able to latch on to Tony Schumacher. Tony is, lots of people know Tony around here. He's the owner and chief meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service. His 31-year career included working as a meteorologist for WAOW-TV in Wausau from 1999 to 2023. And now, of course, he is the chief meteorologist, owner of the Great Lakes Weather Service. And it's great to have him with us. We can talk pretty much, I'm pretty sure. Welcome, by the way. Thank you so much, Tony, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know we can talk weather and climate in general, but I also wanted to zero in a little bit on this part of the state. Before we get going on that, I want to talk a little bit about the Great Lakes Weather Service, mm-hmm. because you know, I went online to take a look at it. I thought, okay, this. I wonder if this is a one-person operation. And then I see you got, what, five or six meteorologists.
Right. We've actually been expanding in this past year. This is a company that started about 50 years ago in Wisconsin by a different gentleman. And I worked for him right out of college part-time and for a couple of years, and I really enjoyed it. But I was also in the TV business, and one thing led to another, and I got a job opportunity. Hop from Channel 7 in Wausau to a Green Bay station.
Yeah.
And so I had to say goodbye to Great Lakes Weather for a couple of years. But I had told the owner that I said, if you ever want to sell it, let me know. I'd be interested in getting into that. And sure enough, a couple of years later, he wrote me a letter and saying that he needed to retire because of health reasons. Mm-hmm. And I was able to work out a deal with WAOW-TV in Wausau, who mm-hmm. wanted me to come back and work in Wausau as well. To help me purchase that company, and I've been running it ever since, about 25 years. So.
Yeah, it's amazing, give my hand on that. I think what people may not realize that it's not just related to the TV programs. That certainly is, but right. but there's a whole lot more involved here.
Absolutely, we provide forecasts to agriculture, which is so important to this part of Wisconsin and all through the Midwest. We have utility companies as customers, school districts, road construction, paving operations. We have marine interests like ferries that cross the Great Lakes, ski hills, plowing operations for city street departments for their winter ice and snow removal, outdoor events like large public theaters outside. It just goes on and on and on. There's always the very acute need for critical weather information.
So. I guess what interested me, what I thought was really cool, is you, the company, provides very specific information to these individual clients.
Right. That's the whole thing with it, is that we're able to deal with them on an individual level, dial in and produce a forecast down as close as we possibly can for their area. And that's a big difference between my TV career and this career. TV is broadcast as much of radio. You know, we're covering, for example, the Wausau market was like 17 counties, basically all the way from the upper Michigan border down to Wisconsin Dells almost. And so as you can imagine, on many days, the weather is wildly different from county to county, even within a county. But yet you're living in the confines of time in TV where you have to produce a weather broadcast that's maybe 30 seconds long or sometimes 3 minutes long and try to break down what's happening in all these places, not only for the next couple of hours, but for the next 7 days. And that's really a struggle that I kind of felt my whole career in TV, is that I always had more inside me than I could actually get out because the time just, you know, cuts you off. And so that's what I like about my own business, is that we're able to really spend more time and be more detailed with each customer.
And all your staff, they're all trained meteorologists and...
That's correct. And they all have, you know, specialties. Some really enjoy certain types of severe weather. Some like winter weather. Some enjoy lake effect snow. Some are, you know, and which is good. We want a variety of different strengths putting together a team like that.
You said you learned a lot about lake effect, how the lake affects weather. I saw somewhere you said when you were in Green Bay, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I worked in Green Bay for 2 years and got to watch some crazy storms coming off the Bay of Green Bay and Lake Michigan, and had viewers, real localized spots along the shore of Lake Michigan that will get dumped with a surprise 8 inches of lake effect snow, and just different things like that that we'd watch very carefully. And we had our crazy winter there when I was there, the winter of 1997 and 98. I'm not sure if you remember that. That was a super warm winter. We had a super El Nino, just like we had this past winter. And we were setting record high after record high. It was still about 60 degrees going up to Christmas. People were out golfing, grass was green. And I actually had a chance to be on CNN because they caught on that the weather was so crazy up in the frozen tundra. Because, you know, the Packers had just won the Super Bowl in 1997, so we were kind of popular yet at that time. So anyway, they got a hold of my TV station, WFRV, and they had me do a live shot with one of their anchors, their news anchors, during their noon show, and to talk about the warm weather. But the thing I'll never forget about that is he could not get our call letters right. He was trying to introduce me, and he kept saying, well, now from WFRI, WVFR, WF, and then he finally gave up and jumped to my name. So I was thinking, oh, no, my one shot at national fame, and it got messed up.
And then here I was today introducing you and rushing and saying Dick Pavelski. Tony Schumacher.
It's okay.
I don't know what it is about your name, Tony. You know, the technology today, I mean, what are you, I mean, you're working on the latest and greatest stuff.
Well, that's really awesome. You know, when I look back to when I started my career in 1993 to now, it's just like night and day difference. My first TV job in Wausau at Channel 7, we were allowed to download 4 satellite images a day. That's it, every 6 hours. And then when I did my 10 o'clock news, I was able to loop those 4 images together and make a crude loop of what was going on. But boy, all the information in between that was happening that I couldn't show or track. We were still using the radar from NINA, the old radar system, which was very crude. It was not a Doppler radar, and we were a long ways from the radar site. So we were very limited. Computer models were crude yet. They did not come out very often. And we had to use the old diffax printers. I don't know if any of you know what a diffax printer is, but it's kind of an analog thing that when the information came in, it would go, chirt, 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 chirt. And so, you know, we knew a weather model should be coming in at 6 a.m., but it would probably take about 6 hours to print. And so by the time we saw it, you know, it was well out of date. But nowadays, everything is instantaneous. We're getting high-resolution images, you know, down to a half a mile or less, every few minutes, anywhere in the world, via the internet and other means. Radar technology has been advancing steadily as well, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So just trying to sort through all this great data we have nowadays is really tremendous.
Tony Schumacher, our guest today, owner and chief meteorologist at the Great Lakes Weather Service. Of course, he's had a long and distinguished career at WAOW-TV as well. Questions for him? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You got a weather question? We'd love to hear it. Or maybe you've got something about a question about Tony's own experiences in the weather forecasting business. 800-642-1234. You could also email us to talk@wpr.org. Or somebody in the live audience here today, if you have a question or a comment for Tony, just go ahead and raise your hand, and we will. Jill Nadoa, our executive producer, is big smile on her face right now. She travels over to find a person who wants to ask a question, and we'll get that in just a minute. You know, what is it about, I just want to ask, weather meteorologists on TV are often the most liked. They are often the most liked people, and they're often asked to do kind of weird things from time to time.
Great.
I was thinking of a guy, you may have remembered this name, Elmer Childress, mm-hmm. was a weather forecaster, and he worked in Madison for many years. And he would be involved, and he might sing a song. He would just do anything anybody asked him. And you probably get a little of that, too.
Well, you know, I think it goes back partly to the old day of TV news way back when it started. The weather person often was kind of an entertainer. They weren't necessarily a scientist.
Yeah.
You know, like the Willard Scott types. And I worked with a gentleman named, a very beloved name, Howard Gernetzky. I'm sure some of you know Howard. I loved Howard. In fact, when I first worked at Channel 7, I had to prepare his weather broadcast for him, his maps and everything. And I learned a lot from him about just being a performer, because when you're up in front of the camera or in front of the microphone, you are a performer, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And hopefully you can get the information in without compromising it. But people want to have a pleasant experience when they're watching or listening. And so that's probably part of it. You know, and part of it is with people liking the weather person is that weather affects everybody, right? Unless you stay inside your entire life and do nothing outside, mm-hmm. you know, weather, even if you stay inside, weather affects you. It affects how you heat your house or your building. It affects brightness and, you know, all sorts of things. So it's kind of a common denominator that everybody can talk about to one level or another, and I think that draws people to weather people. But on the other hand, I will say we do get the ire of people as well. It's not all good. I mean, I have had death threats over the years. You know, people call up and say we ruined their picnic or their big activity because we said it was going to be sunny and a shower popped up or whatever. And you know, you hope that never happens, but it is, some people do take it overboard. And I had people tell me they were pointing a gun at me and, you know, things like that. So it's not all great.
Yeah. Well, I think for the most part, though, you're pretty, you and your compatriots are pretty well liked.
I think so. Yeah, overall, very much so.
We have a question from the audience, I believe. Let's take that.
Hi, thanks for being here. My question has to do with weather terminology. Mm-hmm. A few years back, my husband and I were traveling through Kentucky and had to stay in a hotel and made some chit-chat with a local person, and I happened to mention a weather event that they were going to be having, a bomb cyclone.
Oh.
And he very quickly told me that was fake news, there was no such thing, and now they're just making up terms. So terms that we hear now, like bomb cyclone, polar vortex, derecho, I don't remember hearing those like 20 years ago. So has that always been the terminology, and why are we now hearing it?
Well, yeah, certainly. Those are things that have been around for 50, 100 years or more, those terms, but they were kind of reserved to the academic community, maybe a college. It goes back to the last question. You know, in the old days, the weather people were more entertainers or just friendly people delivering a forecast that they pulled off from the National Weather Service and basically just presented. But as the broadcasters themselves became scientists, it became part of our job, essentially, to be educators besides just presenters. So I think that's probably where it comes from. And now in the day of internet, everybody can look up those things on their own. And so then they're super curious about it because they read about it. They see somebody posting on Facebook about it. And so then you're kind of forced in a way to talk about things that maybe you wouldn't have, but now that kind of the cat's out of the box or whatever, you know. But I think it's a good thing. It's all good to educate the public. And, you know, some people might think it sounds scary to say polar vortex, but it's an actual physical thing. And so we just got to talk about it.
Yeah, there you go. Tony Schumacher, our guest today, Chief Meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service, our guest. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org, or we'll take a question from the audience. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. taking a look at weather and climate right now and zeroing in on, well, I would say the Central Sands area of Wisconsin, just a little bit with our guest, Tony Schumacher, owner and chief meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service. He spent many years at WAOW-TV in Wausau. We're here to answer your questions, and we have a question from the audience, so let's go there.
Thank you. Being an avid cross-country skier, I'm wondering if we'll have a normal winter of snows this winter. And second question is, how often do you reference the Farmer's Almanac?
As far as the snow goes, there's a pretty good chance we'll have a decent winter, at least an average winter. It certainly should be much better than last year for cross-country skiing based on what we're seeing with the La Nina ocean pattern developing that typically usually brings us above normal precipitation in Wisconsin during the winter. Now, temperatures can fluctuate up or down during La Nina, so that can be an issue, but overall it trends around average or maybe a little cooler. So hopefully you can get those skis out many, many times this year.
I was wondering specifically about January 11th. Can you
really?
Tell me?
Wow. That's going to be maybe if you call me in a week, I'll be able to.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and as far as the second part of the question, the Farmer's Almanac, it's fun to look at. I think every year on TV I talked about it or when I was doing my radio broadcast just to say what they were saying, but I really never put much stock in it, and I didn't really know any meteorologist that did.
John Martin, who is one of our weather guys, hates discussions about
right.
about it.
No, it's fun to look at, but honestly, there's really no credible scientific reasoning to it. So if they happen to get lucky once in a while, so be it, but it's nothing we can hang our hat on.
Let's take another question from the audience, and then we'll go to the phones.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. We've been lucky to see the Northern Lights a few times this season, and I'm wondering, is there a correlation between the Northern Lights and our weather?
Well, you know, that's kind of an interesting question. There's certainly research ongoing in regards to that, but, you know, nothing real solid as far as weather down that we experience here. It's more in the upper atmosphere. As you get into the layers, that's bordering space where things can change a little bit. But I'm sure in upcoming years, as we get more technology up in space, we'll get a little bit better handle on that. But it probably does. You know, everything is related in our Earth atmosphere universe in one way or another. So it would not surprise me.
Andy in Door County will take a question from you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good afternoon, Larry and Tony. Thanks for taking my question. My question was, I think, August 23rd of 1998, we had a water spout that came across the bay of Green Bay from that spawned from a supercell and then turned into a tornado that went through the Egg Harbor, Carlsville area in Door County. And I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that. Is that kind of a rare event that occurs, or is that more common than we think? And just wanted to get your thoughts on it. Thank you for taking my time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is sort of rare. Tornadoes don't happen all too often over the Great Lakes. It's more of the water spout, the real transient features that are a little bit different than supercell thunderstorms. So to have kind of a hybrid like that was unusual. I do remember that system vaguely. So that's really the main one that sticks out in my mind of working in Wisconsin for many years that was kind of that hybrid case. Usually the water spouts, you know, just pop up without a major thunderstorm around. So we'll see what happens, but that's always something to watch for if you're a mariner, for sure.
I got to believe the Doppler radar made a huge impact for you as somebody trying to follow or predict or follow the path of tornadoes.
Yeah, tornadoes and high winds both, because now we are able to actually get an estimate of how strong the winds might be and where in relation to spots on the earth that wind is changing in direction. So my first experience was with the Big Flats tornado of August of 1994. We had just had the new National Weather Service radars installed, at least they were starting to get installed. We had one in Sullivan, which is between Madison and Milwaukee. And with that radar, we were able to actually get a pretty good bead on the Big Flats tornado coming into Adams County. We could actually see the circulation of that EF3 tornado, which inevitably did take the lives of two people and injured quite a few others, but still we had a good lead time on it. The warnings came out to help hopefully save a lot of lives. And of course, over the years, we've had many examples now of tracking them. And there's even more tools with the Doppler which have came online in recent years, including the dual pole Doppler radar, which gives us even more information about the air circulation and winds and so on inside tornadoes. And we can now pick up things like debris signatures. So if a tornado is picking up a bunch of debris, there's a special signature that shows up on that dual pole radar, things like that. So it's really great. I hope that continues.
And I know we have another question from the audience, but before we get to that, let's go to Joan in Scandinavia. Joan, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Tony. I have a reason. One of the main reasons I watch the news every evening is for the weather. And I'm 80 years old, so I go way back watching the weather from Bill Carlson. He was a weatherman on WTMJ. He had paper charts like a teacher or professor would have and like a magic marker. So it was pretty cool then. But now I've been noticing the weathermen are so rushed. I watch all the weather shows on different channels, from Green Bay and Wausau. And it just seems like they aren't given enough time. And then they have to talk so fast just to get everything in that they want to say. And so I don't understand why sports are given more time than weather, because the weather.
All right, Joan, thanks for that. Thanks for that question. Tony, well, you probably don't know why the heck sports gets more.
Well, I happen to like sports, so I don't mind that too much. But, you know, there's a whole lot of people that work together to put a newscast on. There's producers, there's directors, there's news directors, there's the advertising team that wants to see their ads get on the show. You know, it all has to pay for itself. We have to pay for all the fancy equipment that we use. We have to pay for the vehicles that drive around and get reports. So there's a lot that goes into it. I agree, though, it would be nice to have a little more time for weather. That's my field. But the good thing is when there's really severe weather, the producers are really generous. And they'll say, hey, take another minute, whatever you need to cover the situation. So in those critical times, you can do that. And then all the plus thing, too, is with the internet and the websites and your apps, the information you maybe didn't see on TV, you can catch on your phone through our station or through whoever you're watching. Or through the internet. So yeah, there's other places to get it now.
Yeah. A question from the audience.
I'm curious about your technologies being used for the smoke forecasts, if there even is such a thing, because it seems like that's a fairly, not a new phenomenon, but you're catching up to it. Because I can hear, two days from now it's gonna rain. We don't hear anything about 3 days from now there's going to be smoke in the air, and when we do, it's usually relayed, it's talked about as haze. Is haze and smoke different?
Well, they can be related, but they can be different as well. You know, haze can be caused by multiple different things, not necessarily just smoke. It often is very hazy when it's smoky out, of course, but yeah, you know, technology is getting better. Satellites are getting more in tune with the type of chemicals to look for in terms of tracking it from space. There's more and more instruments being deployed in the ground that can measure smoke particles and the concentrations thereof, and networks being developed where that can be displayed. So the National Weather Service, like the DNR, is getting heavily involved in this. There's kind of a cooperation, and we're definitely getting more lead time. And we even have weather models now that have that parameter in there that can help us see where they expect the smoke to move based on where it's located height-wise and how the winds are behaving. So I think you'll be hearing more and more about this in future years, for sure.
And just as an aside on that, with climate change and, you know, the fires in Canada were probably a result of not as much moisture and higher temperatures than have been exhibited in the past.
Yes, they had a prolonged, last summer in particular, they had a really long drought across much of Canada, and that coupled with high temperatures, and then, of course, fires get started a variety of ways, lightning, human activities, some are arson, of course, and all that just played a horrible trick on everybody last summer. So, and you know, with the climate changing, it's been long predicted by the models that we are going to have more extreme precipitation cycles. whether it be extreme heavy precipitation for periods, could be weeks on months in certain areas, followed by droughts in other parts that'll be more intense. And so this is going to be a major concern for us all in future years.
Let's take another question from the audience.
An earlier question was asking about the winter coming up, and is it going to be a harsh winter or strong? Are there any animals or farm animals, or do their coats change or something like that? Or is there anything to that where animals are predictors of what kind of winter's coming up?
Well, you know, of course, I've read a lot of those over the years, and people have told me, you know, that the woolly caterpillar, how wide the stripe is, or how thick the breastbone is on a goose, and many different things like that. The squirrels are gathering lots of acorns and this and that. I haven't found one that's foolproof, have you? I mean,
no.
It's fun to talk about. I mean, in way back, you go hundreds of years before we could forecast the weather with equipment, they had to come up with some way to try to organize life, and so they looked to the animals, basically. But I have noticed that the geese do tend to migrate a little quicker when we get some of those sharp cold blasts in November with the strong north winds for a couple of days, but you know, that's just time of the year that they go anyway, so it's hard to say.
And the wind is playing a role. If they got to follow,
exactly.
If they got a wind that they can jump
favorable.
On. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Another question from the audience.
How do weathermen know what the weather is going to be like?
A young participant here.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, you know, it's a very complicated thing. It's like putting a recipe together. If you're baking a batch of cookies, you take some flour, you take some eggs and, you know, water and milk and vanilla and all that good stuff and chocolate chips, and you have to measure it out in just the right proportion. We have to look at all the information and then put it together. So we're looking at satellite information to help us see where the storm systems are in the clouds. We look at radar to see where precipitation is. We look at weather maps that plot current weather conditions around the Midwest and around the whole world, for that matter, to see where fronts are, like cold fronts and warm fronts and low pressure and high pressure, how they're all moving. And then we use our training and weather models to help us look into the future. So we put that all together, and we use our experience from similar situations in the past to say, hey, when that front was sitting over here this time of the year, this is what happened. Could this happen again? So that all has to work together, and we look at storm reports that are coming in live, and it's kind of a complicated thing, Larry.
It is indeed. And there's a fair amount of training that goes into that.
Absolutely.
You know, talk about your own training. You were at UW.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, probably took courses from our weather guys.
I did. They were very young professors at that time. And I went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, studied there for 4 years. But even before that, I knew I loved the weather already as a young child. Probably by the time I was 6, I knew I wanted to do something with weather. So I read every book I could get my hands on with the weather, magazines. That was in the days before internet, back in the 1970s and 80s. But I found, even in 4-H, I took a weather project and made a barometer or something like that. So, but yeah, you can learn a lot on your own, but then you really do need the expertise of those who have studied it many years if you want to become a career meteorologist.
A little bit of math and physics and so forth goes into it as
Correct.
Well.
Correct. And then, to be an active forecaster, just plain old experience doing it time and time and time again, getting fooled a bunch of times and then remembering your mistake and and then learning how to communicate it too is a big part of it, Larry, because it's one thing to know what you're looking at, but then how do you explain that to the rest of the people?
Absolutely. Well, let's take another question from the audience.
Before, when you were talking about meteorologists either being really well liked or not so much, I just have a little story is that when you first came on the air, my mom was probably in her late 70s, she was enamored with you. So Christmas was coming up, but not in a weird way, just in a cute way. So Christmas was coming up, and somehow we got a glossy picture of you from the station, and you signed it with her name, and you wrote her a little thing,
mm-hmm.
And to the day she died, she had that in a frame, right, sitting on the fireplace mantle.
Well, thank you.
That is great. That's great. Well,
yeah, I've had several stories like that over the years, believe it or not, and I'm just thankful it worked out so well. Sometimes it felt like it was going to be a disaster, but we always got through it somehow. So,
oh, thanks so much for that. Let's take another call. Bill in Menominee, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
My question was, with the fires in Canada and California, that's generally where we hear about the smoke generating, originating from, is there a meteorological explanation why the concentration in northern Wisconsin is so heavy?
Of the smoke?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you know, part of it is that we just lie in what's called the mid-latitudes. It's kind of an area of the world between about 35 and 50 degrees latitude where most of the weather systems track through at one time or another. The jet stream winds are usually pretty strong in that area. Those are winds up, you know, 15 to 30,000 feet. And so once that smoke, that wherever it's being generated, gets up into those winds, it's going to circulate the world basically on the strongest core of winds. And they happen to come through Wisconsin more often than not. So that's the big part of it. Once they get lofted up there 20, 30,000 feet. And then as we have fronts coming through, even with rain and snow and so on, that can help drag some of that smoke aloft down toward the ground. So we've got a lot of things going on here that kind of make it a perfect storm. And then if we have a slow moving pattern where it happens to be here, like last summer, and nothing to move it loose, we happen to have a lot of high pressure nearby. It just sat over us forever. It was horrible. Yeah.
Have you seen the latest movie, Tornado?
Oh, Twister.
Twister, sorry.
You know, I have not. I have not had time. Like I said, my company right now has been growing the past 6 months, so very busy. But I certainly want to see it, and I've heard it's pretty good. Have you seen it?
I haven't. I thought, oh, I'm going to just ask you that just to see what your response might be if you had seen it, how accurate it looked. I've heard some... actually, a lot of pretty positive things about Twister.
Yeah, they generally try to consult with scientists to try to get it as reasonable as possible. So,
Natalie in Menominee, Michigan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. I'm wondering if your expert knows anything about, well, just one thing in particular about Project 2025. And one of them is if a certain candidate gets elected in November, his administration will eliminate NOAA. And the question is, what things will we as the people be missing without it?
Yes, I have heard that. And then I do believe that's in there. One of the proposals in that document, whoever produced it, is that they would like to get rid of NOAA. I don't know if it's a cost-saving measure or... I think part of it is they... This is an explanation I've read, is that that particular side believes that NOAA is largely responsible for producing research on climate change, and that climate change upsets them. They'd rather just ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. Well, anyway, I think it would be a horrible thing to get rid of NOAA. They're kind of the backbone of the weather information pipeline of our country and really of the world to a large degree. They fund a lot of the satellites that we use. Of course, the really important Doppler radar that we use. It would basically be back to 1800 for all of us in terms of weather in a lot of ways. It really would. The only way you would get your weather is to have somebody maybe freely supply the information on the internet, but probably not because they're going to have to spend their time and expertise to produce it. So right now we're all helping to fund the National Weather Service and NOAA through our tax dollars, because it all benefits us all. Can you imagine how commerce would come to a standstill if we didn't have relatively accurate predictions on a broad scale of weather coming in, how coastal cities might get clobbered by a hurricane that they didn't know was coming? It could be catastrophic. And for those of you at home, you know, watching, you like to get your weather off of TV. Well, there's a fair number of TV meteorologists that rely on all the warnings from the National Weather Service and NOAA to rebroadcast to you, tornado warnings, severe thunderstorm warnings, flood warnings, blizzard warnings, you name it. So I hope that doesn't happen, honestly. Yes.
Let's go to Dean in, who's west of Denver, Colorado, on the air. Dean, hi.
Hi, and thanks for putting on this show. It's been really entertaining and interesting. We sailed the Apostle Islands last year, and that was a revisit from almost 40 years prior. And I was amazed how much warmer that area has gotten in that time, water temperature. And I was wondering if that's led to any visible or substantial changes in thunderstorm activity, since there's a lot more, I would think, moisture, warm, moist air available?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know a couple of things that I've read with research-wise. One is that the warmer Great Lakes have caused it to become windier near the Great Lakes. There's just more mixing of the atmosphere overhead because that warmer air can rise higher and tap into stronger winds and bring them down. So that may play a role in thunderstorms. I think when we're getting talking about the warmer Great Lakes too, we really notice the volatility more in the late fall and winter. Because the water's warmer going into the winter than it used to be, the early parts of winters are often much warmer than they used to be around here in the upper Midwest, close to the Great Lakes. We often get rain closer to the coast, much longer into the winter than they used to. And also, the lake effect snow can become more intense if the water temperature is warmer, because then there's a greater difference between the water temperature and the cold air coming in from Canada. So those are a couple of things. As far as the thunderstorm intensity, I haven't read anything particularly about that, but that would not surprise me. You know, it's common for thunderstorms to weaken in the summer as they head toward the waters of the Great Lakes, just because it's cooler than the land typically. But at night, if that water ends up being warmer, much warmer than the air over the land, it could be stronger at night. So that'll definitely bear watching. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, it was a great question. Tony Schumacher, our guest today, chief meteorologist and owner of Great Lakes Weather Service. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are broadcasting from Plover, Wisconsin. It's great to have a chance to visit with guests from this area and also to have a live audience. So it's wonderful as we talk weather right now and climate with Tony Schumacher of the Great Lakes Weather Service. And you can join in 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@wpr.org. Or we'll take a question from our live audience, and we have one right now, so let's go there.
Thank you. Tony, as you were answering your last question especially, it's just amazing the depth of the science and just the really deep knowledge that you have. And you had said a while back that you always knew you wanted to be in weather.
Yes.
What? And here it's your career. I mean, you're super involved. What was it that...
Well, you know, I grew up on a dairy farm here right in north central Wisconsin, and the weather just affected us so much. I just everything we did, you know, I still remember how we'd have nice hay cut in the field and all of a sudden a surprise thunderstorm would come in and wash it away, you know, and it would ruin... And we were not rich. We had a family of 8 children, and I was the youngest, and our parents put us all through college on that. I don't know how, but they did. But, you know, just the struggles that the weather gave us and the joys, too, because sometimes it helped us produce some really nice crops for our cows and had a great year. But I always wondered what was causing these things, the thunderstorms and the lightning and the snowstorms in the winter that would blow and drift and block our roads shut. And so I attributed to that. I think it just I was out in the weather so much as a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's that makes a lot of sense. Thanks so much for that question. I think we've got Mike and, well, let's see, we've got an email, let me take that. Mike and Nina wonders, what do you mean when you say a 20% chance of rain or snow?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to look at it. Generally, the lower the number, of course, the lower the chance is going to be. I was taught way back when I started, basically a 20%, it's the coverage of the shower activity or snow, whatever it happens to be. So basically 100% chance that a shower will occur or rain will occur, but only covering 20% of the area. So in your viewing area, if you say there's a 20% chance of showers, you'd expect about one out of every 5 places to be hit by some rain or snow. There's other ways to look at it too. You know, it's just, it's kind of a complicated thing, but in general, small chances, less chance of precipitation, high chances, high confidence. It's just kind of don't look too much into it if you're just a viewer. But know that, you know, if there's a 30% chance of rain, that doesn't mean it can't rain at your house, okay? It means that there's a chance, but we do expect it to be scattered in nature.
All right. Let's take a question now from Mike in Wausau. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I was wondering, Tony, can you talk about the effect of large metropolitan areas like the Twin Cities has on your forecasts, being that they're such a heat sink?
That's right. Well, I do have customers in the Twin Cities, quite a few of them, actually. And they're part of a large urban heat island, of course. You know, that metropolitan area stretches about 60 miles in any one direction. Just a lot of concrete, a lot of buildings absorbing heat and putting out heat. And so they're often, at night especially, 5 to 8 degrees warmer than the surrounding areas. You can even notice that in Stevens Point or Wausau area. The airport in Wausau, which is downtown, often runs 8 or 10 degrees warmer than at night on a clear night than the surrounding countryside. So we always have to take that into consideration for temperature forecasting. Also for the formation of ice and snow in the winter on roadways in particular. You know, it's often just wet in the city, in the inner part of the cities, but it might be slippery or slushy, snow covered on the outskirts. So those are definitely some real concerns. And there's some wind issues that go on with the terrain of a city and so on versus the country and other things as well.
Well, Jill is looking at me and saying, hey, I've got somebody here who wants to ask a question that they want to ask. And so I will get back to snafus in just a minute. Let's go there.
Hi. I am old, and so when I was growing up, there were like three basic kinds of clouds. And I was taught that if you see the cirrus clouds, it's going to rain within a day. Is that true?
Well, it's not 100% correlation, but it is generally kind of a good rule of thumb. You know, generally as a storm system gathers off to the west a few states, you'll start to see high, thin cirrus clouds come in. You might see a ring around the moon at night or a halo around the sun. And then as the system gets closer, the clouds will lower and eventually become stratus or nimbostratus or some variation thereof. As the moisture gets deeper and produce precipitation. But it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes we just have cirrus clouds drifting through without any precipitation associated with them. So you have to be a little bit careful with some of those general rules.
Val in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there.
Hi, I'm also on the older side, and I have a question that I remember it not ever being this hot and humid when I was a kid. And I'm wondering if the excessive humidity that we're having, like today, do you think it's related to something called the corn sweat, which means now as the corn crop comes on and we're cultivating so much more in the field that it's contributing massive amounts of humidity over the Midwest, and it's just building up humidity like we've never had before. Is that a thing?
Well, we've always had corn sweat. That is a real thing, by the way. You know, corn emits a huge amount of moisture as it's growing, especially when it's about in its mid-cycle, maybe more like in July, early August, which can raise the dew point by maybe as much as 3 to 5 degrees in a particular area. This has been well studied in Iowa, especially.
Very much, yes. In Iowa.
So that's nothing new. I mean, yeah, we do grow a little more corn, I believe, than we used to, so that might be a small indicator, but more importantly, with a warmer ocean atmosphere system that we have, it is holding more water vapor. So, you know, it's estimated already that we're, I believe, holding about 7% more water vapor than we were just, you know, like 60 to 80 years ago. So that's got to go somewhere. And if we happen to have the right wind flow to push it here and hold it here for a while, working with those other things, it can feel excessively muggy. And that's one of the reasons we're getting some of these extreme precipitation events where, like, you get 6 inches of rain in one storm. And this happened for many hundreds of years, of course, but it's happening with more frequency now. And part of that is because we just have more water in the air.
Take a question from the audience.
Tony, can you explain the correlation between humidity and dew point and which one makes you feel most uncomfortable?
Well, you know, dew point is a better absolute measure. You know, a dew point of, say, 65 degrees Fahrenheit will always feel muggy, whereas a relative humidity could be 90%, and it may not feel muggy at all, depending on the temperature. Basically, dew point is the measure of when moisture will start to condense out and form dew. So at night, as the temperature is dropping, it might be 70, and then get down to 60, you might start getting wet grass or dew on your windshield. That's about the dew point. So the higher the dew point, the more moisture the air is holding. When the dew point and the air temperature are the same thing, then the relative humidity is 100%. But as I say, if the dew point's only 40 and the temperature is 40, it's going to feel a little moist outside, but maybe not uncomfortable, muggy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the dew point is a very important measure for us.
Yeah, excellent. Another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm wondering why sports broadcasters at the end of their broadcast at either 5 or 6 o'clock will say severe weather ahead, tune in at 10. And you would think that they would give a little bit more information at 5 and 6 when most of us are awake, rather than at 10 when we've already slept for 2 hours.
Oh, those teases.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure why the sports people would be doing that, but I think the weather people are doing that just to get people hooked so they watch at 10 o'clock for an update. Hopefully they've watched already for the main part of the show at 5 or 6, but you can get more information at 10. You know, that's the whole part of TV. There's a whole marketing part, and that's above my pay grade, but, you know.
Kathy in Viroqua, we'll go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question is, I'm wondering if you know how effective current firefighting methods have been this year on the ground and from the air, and if any new methods are being developed or even possible.
That's a really good question. I'll be honest, I'm not really a firefighting expert, so I won't be able to answer that super well. Larry, do you know anything about that?
I don't, but that's actually that's something. That might be a show, Jill.
I'm sure like any other field, there's advancements being made all the time in research, but I'm just not aware of what they exactly are.
But, you know, it intrigues me, so maybe we can work a half-hour segment into one of our shows. That might be a nice thing to do when we have another Weather Guys show. So stay tuned for that, for sure. And Tony, this has been just great. I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure to be here and meet some people and talk about the weather. Again, my lifelong passion, and hopefully can do it a long time yet. So.
I hope so, too. Tony Schumacher, owner and chief meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service, started his career long time back in 1993, and he's still working, and he's got a really good thing going with the Great Lakes Weather Service, a great bunch of professionals work with clients all over the place, giving specific weather information for those clients. Takes a lot of people to bring you this broadcast live from Plover. I want to thank our friends, certainly from the Farm and Food Exploration Center. Explorefoodandfarm.org. Explorefoodandfarm.org. Go there for more information. And of course, I want to thank WPR's Wausau Regional Manager, Katie Land, who's done a great job. The Senior Regional Manager, Lisa Nelbandian, our technical directors, Tom Blaine, Tyler Ditter, and Jeff Robbins, and in Madison Lee Rayburn. Joel Patnod, our producer today and our executive producer with that microphone running around, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thanks to you, our audience. It's been great fun, and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.